It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why moms-to-be in America's rural areas are increasingly having trouble finding the prenatal care they need.
First, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs released the results of a federal survey of the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King yesterday. The survey was requested by U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin back in January. The report showed the home didn't meet three of 158 standards required of state veterans' nursing homes.
Caitlin Farrell has been following the allegations against the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King, and she joins us now to talk about this latest development. She's a reporter for the Capital Times. Caitlin, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs inspection found three instances where King failed to meet federal standards. What were specifically those three instances?
Sure. So there were three instances where there was a veteran there who fell from his or her bed, and the federal VA deemed that that was an instance of neglect, which is under their a larger umbrella standard of abuse. And then VA inspectors also found that staff at King then failed to update that same resident's comprehensive care plan following that fall. And then there was a lack of documentation for elevator inspections, and that has to do with national standards for fire safety, people being able to get out of the building if there was an incident of a fire. So those are the three standards that they found that the home did not meet.
So two of those three that you just mentioned were related to one resident and started with that fall from the bed. What do we know about that resident and what happened?
Sure. So the way that these reports are set up, doesn't give us the resident's name or their sex. It's just a resident who was there. It does say that the incident happened back in October and sort of goes through a series of events. The inspectors there surveyed a variety of nurse aides and staff members, also reviewed that resident's medical records, and then make a determination based on the research and interviews that they do. So, the agency maintains that the resident had a seizure or there was a muscle spasm, and so that led to a fall. But then in the report, when you look at the interviews that the inspectors did of that resident, the resident says that, he or she felt that the staff there was inattentive to his or her care and was somewhat negligent in the way that they were handling the resident in the morning. The resident also in question is a quadriplegic, and so, requires an intensive amount of care. It sort of reads as a somewhat convoluted kind of back and forth of what different people say happened. But at the end of the day, the inspectors then determined that there was a degree of negligence there on the part of staff at King.
And the issue with elevator safety inspections, do we know if this was, one round of inspections that were missed, or is this an ongoing issue?
My understanding from how I'm reading the report is that it was a round of not quite sure so much necessarily a round of inspections that were missed as that the home could not provide documentation of those inspections, the most recent ones that were required. And so, ostensibly the home could have had the inspections done and then just, didn't have the documentation to provide at the time for inspectors, but that's how it's framed in the report. So, at the time that these were needed to come around again and they asked for proof that they had been done, the home could not give that to them. So that's how that's framed.
So as we noted, this survey came out of a request by U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin requesting the inspection. What prompted her to request this kind of inspection of the home?
Sure. So this is actually her second request. She had sent a letter last year to the then VA secretary, and then she sent one in January again. The one last year followed some of the reporting that I did about concerns about the level of care at the home, and then she sent another one in January after I had done another story, which was a report that another federal agency had found that the home had mishandled liquid oxygen. So there was this liquid oxygen incident that had happened there that Senator Baldwin found out about and cited that in her most recent request. And liquid oxygen, is needed for many residents, use that. But if it's mishandled, it can be very dangerous. So she was concerned about that.
And this particular survey is called a four-cause survey. What is that exactly? What does that terminology mean?
Sure. So for cause is basically a complaint-driven survey, essentially. So it's an unannounced, as I reported it in my story yesterday, it's, you know, the federal government defines it as an unannounced federal review to investigate any incidents, complaints, or deficiencies that might jeopardize the health or safety of residents at the home. So this is a kind of an additional inspection mechanism, I guess, that the federal VA can use because they already do survey state veterans' homes annually. In the home, I would imagine would have one coming up probably in June. They had one last June, and they get these surveys that are public records every year if they have inspectors come in. So this is a separate thing.
We're talking with Caitlin Farrell. She is a reporter for the Capital Times, and she has been following closely the allegations of neglect and abuse at the King Veterans Home. Now, what are you hearing from the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs about this federal survey that's come out on King?
Sure. So one thing that they did note, which I did update, and I heard from them later last night, and it's updated now in my story online, but they note that regarding the incident with the resident who fell from his or her bed, they note that they did, as they are required to do, they self-reported that incident to the State Office of Quality Assurance and the federal VA when it did occur. Their spokeswoman, Carla Vigeau, said that in her statement to me last night that she, it's a privilege for them to care for the veterans that are there, and they really view these surveys and inspections as an opportunity for them to improve and get better. And, imagine too, her comment is reflecting the sentiment of the new secretary at that agency who just took office, a little over a month ago.
Mm-hmm. And what do we know about changes that might be made in the leadership at King?
Right. So there's already been several. The former Secretary John Skokus, who had been in the position for a while, he, announced his resignation in November. He left the job in January. Shortly after that, his second in command, Dan Buttery, also left. And then just last week, Sven Zimmerman took office in February, and he announced to staff at the Department of Veterans Affairs that he was reassigning the top official at King, and that's Commandant is the position who runs the home. So Commandant Jim Knight had been in the job for a while, and he's going to be reassigned to his new job is fiscal compliance auditor, and they have an open call, I believe, to bring someone new in to lead the home there.
And the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King is a state-run facility. How much jurisdiction does the federal government have over this facility?
So the VA surveys, in some sense, is the main kind of like check or mechanism of that. It is mostly the jurisdiction falls within the state because it's run by the state. But it does get, the home gets quite a bit of money from the federal government. They get per diem payments, which are sort of like cost of living, daily expense payments from the federal government each year. And they also get, depending on veterans and what, their services, they get service-connected disability payments from the federal government. So because in many cases a veteran is going to get financial benefits from the federal VA instead of the state VA, the federal VA, wants to track and see how their money is being used and spent. And I think, making sure that the money they're funneling down to the states are being spent in the right way, which is why they, they thoroughly survey the home over 158 standards to sort of make sure that, they're running properly as the federal government sends its money there.
And Caitlin, as we wrap up, what do you expect to happen next? What kind of impact might this survey have?
So, it will be interesting to see. I think that overall, I guess I can't really speak for the agency so much, but I think many people following the story are interested to see the results of the audit that the state legislature is doing. In this survey, the home met a vast majority of the standards that it was tested upon, 155 out of a 158. But I think people watching this are interested to see sort of what the audit committee, says they're doing. Governor Walker also has asked for more money in both of his budgets to, be funneled towards King. So it'll be interesting to see what those developments bring and how that shakes out. So that's sort of the next thing I'm watching.
Well, Caitlin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Caitlin Farrell, reporter for the Capital Times. You can find a link to her piece on the results of the federal survey on the Wisconsin Veterans Home at King on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, when you lose your job, your income might not be the only casualty. It turns out that our sense of self and identity can also take a hit.
First, when it comes time for a pregnant woman to deliver a baby, many people take it for granted that they can easily jump into the car and drive to the hospital. But for the nation's most rural residents, things are more difficult, and the situation appears to be getting worse.
As rural hospitals and clinics are forced to make cutbacks, maternal health care services are often the first to be cut, according to our next guest. And a forthcoming study from the University of Minnesota Rural Health Research Center finds that more than two-thirds of rural counties in Florida, Nevada, and South Dakota have no in-county obstetrical services.
CDC data also shows that the maternal and infant mortality rates are both higher in rural areas.
Dina Fine-Marin joins us now. She's health and medicine editor at Scientific American and recently wrote a piece called Maternal Healthcare is Disappearing from Rural America. Dina, welcome back to Central Time.
Nice to be here.
Well, if you could paint a picture for us, what are some of the women that you profile facing when they live in these rural areas where there may not be healthcare nearby when they're expecting a baby?
Yeah, so only about 6% of the nation's OBGYNs work in rural areas. So as a result, some women I spoke to for this article told me rather harrowing tales of how women in their area have to drive great distances to deliver a baby or even in some cases to get prenatal care. So less than half of rural women live within a 30-minute drive of the nearest hospital offering obstetrical services. And only about 88% of women in rural towns live within a 60-minute drive. So as a result, some women have taken to camping out near a hospital ahead of their due date, whether it be with a family member or they have the wherewithal to and the monies to be able to stay in a hotel. Obviously, that's a huge inconvenience for them and potentially economically problematic. And some other women I spoke to have even said that they have ended up having to deliver on their way to the hospital in the back of a car or even stopping at an emergency room and delivering in the ER there.
And you said there's also evidence that some women may be opting to get elective C-sections so that they know that they'll be close to their health care when they need it.
Yeah, I spoke to one gentleman who's the executive director of the Alabama Rural Health Association, and he says that he's seen that phenomenon in his state, and that's why he attributes the state's high C-section rate as compared to the national average. He thinks that that's a direct result of some of these distance issues.
I mean, does it also mean that some women may just decide, you know, it's too much of a hassle and I can't get there, so I'm just going to forego some of my health care in the lead up?
Yeah, that is possible. Some women may not be getting as much prenatal care as is recommended due to those distance issues. In the past, family physicians may have moved in to take over some of this care, but those numbers are dropping as well in rural areas of how many family physicians are offering obstetrical care or even prenatal basic care.
Were family physicians able to offer all the services that they might have gotten these women expecting from a specialist?
No, they wouldn't, and that's a great point. Of course, the reality is if a woman is going to it looks like she might have a complicated pregnancy or need certain kinds of prenatal testing or genetic counseling, a family physician would not be well poised to offer all of those services.
And you're saying that even the family physicians who did step in to offer some of those services, that option is starting to go away too. Is that right?
Exactly.
How come? What's happening?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's part of a larger area of talking about what's happening in rural healthcare in general, because people who live in rural communities are more often poorer than those who live in their more urban environments. As a result, they're less likely to have healthcare coverage from a private insurer, and they'll have Medicaid. They'll be reimbursed at lower rates. The doctors will be reimbursed at lower rates. And as a result, doctors have trouble, in some cases, making as much money, and so they may be either leaving those communities or more hesitant to accept patients that don't have private insurance.
And you also write that, in general, obstetrics and gynecology is expensive, it seems like, and it's hard to get a solid number on the budget. You don't know, for instance, how much it's going to cost to deliver a baby.
Yeah, I was really surprised to find that studies have found that obstetrics gynecology accounts for more than 5% of hospital costs. And obviously, one of the reasons that takes place is, let's say you're having a hip replacement. You can know exactly how long it's going to take, most likely, and what resources you will need during that. But obviously, it's hard to anticipate exactly how long it would take to deliver a baby. So the number of nurses and doctors and surgeons and anesthesiologists that must be available throughout that delivery obviously would add up.
We're talking with Dina Fine-Marin right now. She's health and medicine editor at Scientific American, and she wrote a piece recently called Maternal Healthcare is Disappearing from Rural America. And we're curious to hear if this is something that you've experienced here in Wisconsin. Have you had trouble getting the healthcare you need, the prenatal care you need if you're expecting, or getting to the hospital when you need to deliver? How did it affect you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. And Dina, looking closely at why these maternal services are disappearing, what sort of statistics do we have about what's happening and how quickly they seem to be leaving rural counties?
So as I mentioned, this is a larger rural healthcare problem. 80 rural hospitals have been shuttered nationwide since 2010, and a recent study suggests about a third of the country's remaining rural facilities are vulnerable to closure, and that's because they operate at such tight financial margins. So this is a problem we're probably going to see growing in the coming years. For example, in the state of Mississippi, half of Mississippi's rural providers operate at a loss, a financial loss, so that, of course, puts them in some economic difficulty. As far as what can be done to try to address these sorts of problems, the solution isn't clear. Policymakers have suggested maybe if we provide more financial incentives for doctors to work in rural areas who have an OBGYN specialty with things like student loan forgiveness, that might help. So there's a bill right now that's passed the House that hasn't yet been introduced into the Senate that would do just that.
And you tell some stories about, you quote a doctor, for instance, who said maybe there is one doctor in an area who can offer these sort of prenatal services, but they don't want to be the only doctor in the area because you're going to work yourself to death. How does that factor in?
Yeah, it has a multiplier effect, as you mentioned. One doctor I spoke with for this piece talked about how if you are the only OBGYN doctor in the area, obviously you can't predict when women are going to go into labor, so you would potentially be fielding a lot of calls and be on the road driving to a lot of different places. And actually, we are seeing this problem as well with midwives, nurse midwives. I've been asked this question in the past, if hospitals are no longer offering OBGYN care, is that leading to more women giving birth at home and depending on nurse midwives? And the answer is that nurse midwives are also moving out of rural areas. I spoke to some nurse midwives that didn't make it into this piece who said that they, too, are moving out of these areas because they just aren't having enough patients in a rural area to really make ends meet. And that's because of the fact that rural communities in general are graying. It's a demographic fact that reduces the number of births and makes it difficult for a midwife, just like a hospital, to financially justify living in the area.
Let's take a quick question here from Alicia in Milwaukee. Alicia, hi.
Hi. I had a question with respect to infant mortality. As a result of having such a low number of healthcare providers in the rural areas, has it impacted infant mortality? I know in the city of Milwaukee, there's a large number of children that are dying, infants that are dying. And also, what about the impact on the mothers? Are they dying as a result of not having this lack of health care?
Alicia, thanks for that question. And Dina, what do you know about that? And also whether there are long-term health implications for women or their babies because of this?
Yeah, great question. As I discussed in my piece at scientificamerican.com, we don't have any good numbers that point to these long-term answers about whether or not this leads to worse physical or psychological health for the mothers. For this piece, however, I did analyze maternal mortality and infant mortality rates across the nation, breaking those numbers down by how urban a location is versus how rural it is. And for that, I used public Centers for Disease Control data. And I found that, yes, the maternal mortality rate is problematic in rural areas, and that it affects infant mortality rates as well. Infant mortality rates also see those kinds of differences, but we can't connect those dots. We can't say for sure that those are occurring because of these distances the mothers have to travel. We might say, well, rural health care is problematic for other reasons, so perhaps there are underlying health conditions, whether they be hypertension, diabetes, heart issues that might be contributing to these numbers, and again, potentially a lack of prenatal care or robust prenatal care. So until there are greater studies that take place and study these rural communities longer term, we just don't have these answers at all.
And, Dina, you also write about how it could be the part of the solution is to train more doctors explicitly to work in rural areas. And you talk about what the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health is doing in that regard. They have a pioneering program. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so until now there have been tracks within existing medical school programs where, let's say, a doctor might do a rotation during his or her residency in a rural area or have a track within a program that's looking at something else. But the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine Public Health is actually launching it, the nation's first official obstetrics gynecology residential program, and that will start this year, actually. Later this month, the first resident will be matched into it. But when I say resident, note that's singular, and their program for very rural areas is just starting with one resident. And so obviously that isn't a large enough fix to try to look at these issues more broadly, but it is a start. The University of Wisconsin's thought process there was that statistically where doctors train during residency is where they're more likely to end up practicing longer term. So their thought is if you train more doctors, hopefully those doctors will stay.
And just briefly, we're almost out of time. Any other solutions on the table?
Sure. Yeah, another solution that's being talked about is telemedicine, helping to move in for some of the at least prenatal care issues. But what's making that complicated, since telemedicine is a virtual healthcare offering, is that you would often need broadband internet access to make that work. And unfortunately, broadband is something that has not made it to every rural area, and often that is a complication that would mean telemedicine isn't feasible.
Dina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dina Fine-Marin is health and medicine editor at Scientific American, and she talked about a recent article, Maternal Healthcare is Disappearing in Rural America.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about job loss and self-worth. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get the final installment of a series on Wisconsin's Police Academy from WPR Special Projects reporter Bridget Bowden.
First, losing a job can be scary. And in the midst of the Great Recession, plenty of Americans were struggling with unemployment and covering the costs of living. According to our next guest, money isn't the only thing that becomes a top concern after job loss. One of the biggest challenges that can come with unemployment is the change to your identity and how you see your role in the world.
We'd like to hear from you on this over on the Central Time Facebook page. Have you ever lost a job? How did it affect you? And do you think it changed your relationship to your partner, your friends, or maybe even to yourself? You can post your thoughts and see what other people have to say on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now is Dawn R. Norris. She's an assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse, and her book is called Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. Dawn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
In your book, you look at identity and mental health problems that can be related to unemployment. Can you take us through what happens when a person loses their job?
Well, a variety of things can happen, and some of them actually occur prior to losing one's job. One of the things that happens is that people don't feel like they are the same person anymore. That sense of stability of who they are starts to crumble when they no longer have their jobs. In the U.S., who we are is largely based on what we do for a living. One of the first things that people ask us is, what do you do? And we have multiple identities, multiple roles, but a big piece of that is our job. When we lose that sense of stability and we become confused about who we are. One of the most harmful things that can happen, that can harm our mental health, is that loss of identity.
And talking about that term identity, we throw that word around a lot, but in terms of your job, what other words can you use for that? Is part of it a sense of status?
It can be. A sense of prestige is part of it. It can be a sense of who you are, let's say, as a man. For example, men often feel like their job makes them the breadwinner, mm-hmm. and that's a very important thing to many men. In sociology, we tend to think of having multiple identities. There's not just one. We have many identities, and they're often based on our roles, our positions in society, things like being a parent or an author or an athlete or an employee.
And something you focus on in your book is identity mismatches that can happen after job loss. What do you mean by that?
This is when the meaning of one of your identities tends to conflict with the meaning of another identity. So, for example, if the meaning of man is breadwinner and you lose your job, all of a sudden the meaning of unemployed doesn't match with man, and you start to have mental health issues.
And what other emotional challenges can happen when there's that kind of a mismatch? Is part of that going from feeling useful and like you're doing something worthwhile for those 8 or 9 hours a day, and then all of a sudden there's that void?
That's certainly one part of it. What my book focused on went beyond that, that people talked about not being the same person anymore or not getting feedback from other people that they were who they thought they were. For example, one of the people in my book named, I call her Cindy, she's a 62-year-old award-winning account executive in the travel industry. And after the Great Recession, or during the Great Recession, mergers happened. Companies were trying to desperately gain that profit margin and succeed. The merger occurred with the travel company she worked for. And as a result of that merger, they laid many people off, and she was kept on, but she got a new boss. This new boss was younger than her by a couple of decades. And as she was positioned into the new role, her age became a focus for her. She felt that her age of 62 did not match what was expected in the company because she was surrounded by younger people. Additionally, this new younger boss kept telling her, well, you just don't get it. I just don't know why you're just not getting it. Hmm. And eventually she was so concerned that she was having some form of dementia that she went to get tested. She went to a psychologist to be tested to see if she had dementia. She did not. In fact, the requirements they were putting on her were so severe that she found out after she left her job, after she lost her job, she found out that other people were fudging their numbers, that nobody could achieve the requirements that this new boss had put on them. Nevertheless, she interpreted this as being about her age, that her age didn't match her job. And I heard this echoed through several participants.
Are there particular fields where you think there is more of a risk of, when there is a loss of employment, that the people who are now unemployed have more serious challenges with identity and mental health issues? Do you see some sectors where that's more prevalent?
I think it would depend on a number of things. That's a good question. I think that in the tech industry, if you're a little bit older, for example, I have a brother-in-law who is in his 40s and he works for a tech company. He sometimes talks about being the old guy around, and that you know, that mismatch might be there for him. Beyond that, you know, I think that certainly white-collar jobs, people are training for many, many years to be able to get into those positions, whether it's a college degree or professional training. And when you've put so much of your life into, the length of your life into a job, it can become an even stronger part of your identity. That being said, I wouldn't say that working class jobs don't bring a sense of identity. I think they do, but in a different way.
We're talking with Dawn Norris. She's an assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse, and we're discussing her recent book, which is Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health. Now, I wonder, Dawn, if it's something that you got a chance to look at in your research. I can see that if you've been in a career for a long time, that's a big part of your identity, but does it change at all if you've kind of hopped from job to job, or if you've been in one company and lose that company and all the people that come with it? Is that an even more severe loss to deal with?
I think if you are not in one particular position for a long time, it actually makes it easier. The longer we're in a particular role, such as a job, the more ingrained it becomes for who we are. We enact that job every day. We enact that role every day. We act with other people every day who give us feedback that we are the person we think we are. So if you're hopping around from job to job, that might be very disorienting. It might make you feel very unstable and harm your mental health in those ways. But it probably would not harm your identity as much as being in a job for a long time.
So maybe in some ways, if you've moved around a lot, if your career has been a little more dynamic or has had changes kind of a constant to it, maybe you've developed some different skills for dealing with what is a very significant change going from employed to unemployed.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a more flexible batch of skills, a more flexible identity, you can quickly make these shifts, which is one of the strategies I describe in my book, that can help.
And you've done research with middle-class people, specifically, who lost their jobs. What did you hear from them about what their biggest concerns were when they lost their employment?
Well, one of the things I expected to hear was that they were frightened about their finances, but that was not the number one thing. In fact, most of them didn't mention their financial status at all. They independently brought up that their identity, who they were, was threatened. One of the biggest factors was for men. Again, they described themselves in ways that were very negative. They said, oh gosh, society is going to think I'm a slug. Or they described themselves as being impotent. There was some very gendered language being used there. They were very, very afraid, very scared of what society would think of them and what, for many of them, their wives would think of them. So who they were, how they would become that person again that they once were, their selves were really at risk here.
Do you have a sense of how people that fall on either side of the middle class, so higher earners and lower economic status people, how that differs for those groups?
I would suspect, and again, I haven't done research on the working class or lower income earners. I'd love to do that in the future. I think it might look a little different. For one, when your financial status is the most important thing, and you know, when you're working class or earning low income, you just don't have that buffer. So losing your job, the very first thing you're going to think is, oh my gosh, I don't have a job. How am I going to pay my bills? How am I going to feed my kids? Nevertheless, your identity still comes into play, I think, a little bit differently. For example, hey, I was always a union man and now I'm not. Or hey, I'm, you know, me and these women at this diner, we're servers, we're waitresses, we're a group, we're together, and oh my gosh, now we're not. So it might look a little bit different, and the financial concerns might come to the surface more.
We're talking to Dawn Norris, assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse, about her studies on how job loss affects mental health and identity.
And we'd like to hear from you on the Central Time Facebook page. Did leaving a job impact your mental or your emotional health? Did it influence how you saw yourself or your role in life? And tell us if your job and what you do for a living is a big part of your identity on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up the conversation with Dawn Norris, assistant professor of sociology at UW La Crosse. And we're talking about how losing a job can impact identity and mental health.
And we want to hear from you over on the Central Time Facebook page. Has leaving a job ever impacted your relationships? Were you one of the many people that lost their job during the Great Recession? If so, how did you cope with it? Tell us if you had to rebuild your identity or learn to see yourself differently after becoming unemployed. Or did losing your job end up being a good thing in the long run? You can share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, we just asked people, Dawn, about how it might have affected relationships, and you've touched a little bit on the relationship with a spouse, especially for a man who might really identify as being a breadwinner. What do you see in women who lose their jobs and how that might affect their relationship with their family?
It really varies. Some of them went through separations because of the stress on their own identities, and as well as some of the economic stress. Women in general, I found, were a little bit more resilient, and one of the reasons was that some of them felt they could, what I call, shift to a different identity. Many of them shifted to emphasize the mother identity. So, for example, a 41-year-old chief financial officer, who I'll call Charlotte, had told me that throughout her life, she had seen herself as the breadwinner, and she was the sole breadwinner for her family of three. Her husband was a stay-at-home father, and he took care of their two young children. She said, "Thank God I have this set up where my husband takes care of the kids, because if it were me, it would be really messed up." Always saw herself as an employee, and then she lost her job. And it was very stressful for her. She said she didn't know who she was anymore. But within a matter of a few months, she had shifted her emphasis to say, "You know what? I'm a really good mother. And you know what? If I have a bad day, I can just make caterpillars out of egg cartons," I think is what she said. "And I can be super mom." And her whole attitude had shifted. Women were able to do this a lot better than men. Mm-hmm. When men described trying to shift to a father role, and many of them tried, they tried to say, "I'll just be a father." They said, "Well, anybody can be a father." So one man even described it, "Well, to be a father, you just need to be a sperm donor."
I'm thinking, as you're talking about how people transition to retirement, and for some people it can be a very difficult transition because their identity has been their working life for so long. But I'm wondering if you see a difference between assuming that retirement is chosen or at least planned for or at least anticipated, if there's a difference between that and losing your job.
Absolutely. The voluntary or involuntary nature of any transition like this makes a big difference. When we choose to do something, first of all, we have control. And control over our circumstances is one of the most important factors for mental health as well. But certainly when it comes to jobs, if it's involuntary, we don't have time to prepare for how will we handle this new circumstance. Who will I become now? And if you don't have that time to prepare, you're thrown into it. You can fall into what I call identity void, this loss of all sense of self. One of the people I spoke to described that as being like you're dead and nobody told you.
Hmm. Let's go to the phones and bring on Mark, who's in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Mark.
Well, hi. I just wanted to know if you've read anything by Eckhart Tolle. He makes a point that we see ourselves too much and what we do in our accomplishments rather than just being and who we are.
Thanks for that call, Mark. Don?
I have not read that, but I have read some other authors who are making the same argument. And, you know, part of the problem here is that we do live in a culture that emphasizes work and making money and what we do. And it's really, really hard to de-emphasize that when you don't have the support of your culture. Certainly there's some work on Israel, for example, Ofer Sharon's work on Israeli people who have lost their jobs and are seeking work. They're not putting quite as much emphasis on the job as who they are. It's just their batch of skills. And I think sometimes in the U.S. we put so much emphasis on it. We put all our eggs in one basket, and then when it goes, it goes, and we're left without a balanced identity.
Thanks for that call, Mark. Let's go now to Barbara in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, yes. I am 67 years old. I work 40 hours a week as a professional buyer. I've been doing this work for 20, 25 years, and I've been through job losses about three times in the last, since 2002. Mm-hmm. The first time it happened, I had a high school senior that I was providing health insurance for, and I was scared out of my mind. But at the last minute, they decided that, no, they needed to keep me, and I was on a roller coaster ride. I didn't know what felt worse, losing the job or getting the job back.
Yeah.
And then the second time was in 2008, and that time I was prepared for it. I had already secured other employment, and it was a breeze until that company went through a restructuring, and I was let go again. And at that time, my son had left. I had an empty nest. I had no husband, and I was devastated again, but I went back to school, and I got my skills all updated, and now I'm so happily employed, I can't tell you. I don't even know when I'm going to retire.
Well, thanks so much for that, Barbara, and I want to give Dawn a chance to respond. It sounds like Barbara has kind of built in some resiliency.
Yeah, well, it certainly sounds that way. Being prepared, she mentioned, helped her get through that second period of job loss, going back to school and kind of restructuring who she is in some ways. You know, it's interesting because some of the research actually shows that worrying about losing a job can be harder on your physical and mental health than actually losing your job sometime. That uncertainty, you know, at least if you've lost your job, you know, okay, I've lost that. Now I need to move forward. So first of all, Barbara, my apologies to hear about the previous job losses, but congratulations on your new job.
Thanks for sharing that with us, Barbara. And let's stay with our callers and go now to Mary in Dane County. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I lost my job when I was about 61. It was during that recession, and I had been there 17 years, and it came out of the blue. I didn't even know it was going to happen. And it was, I still don't think I've recovered. And mentally or financially, I just feel like, I don't know, I'm afraid to get a job. Mm-hmm. And that's terrible, but it's how I feel.
So, Mary, you said it's been about 7 years or so, and so you've been unemployed since that happened.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Dawn, does that echo to things that you heard from other people?
Yeah, absolutely. For one thing, if you're over 40, and certainly if you're over 60, very real age discrimination exists out there. And it makes it very, very hard to move forward and take that chance and put yourself on the line. Several of the people I spoke to talked about trying to put resumes out there and repeatedly just not hearing anything. You know, we're living in a day and age where you don't get a rejection letter, you just hear nothing. It's radio silence. Mm-hmm. And this was really disturbing to them, to the point where they said, I can't do this anymore. I can't put myself on the line anymore.
Before we have to wrap up, I want to make sure we touch on one other aspect. We talked a little bit about the difference for men and women. What about differences between different racial groups? Did you see any difference there?
I did. I spoke with both white and black participants in my study. Black participants overall were more resilient. However, they had some very specific concerns when they would lose their jobs. For one thing, they mentioned that putting themselves on the line was a little bit different in terms of worrying about racial discrimination. For example, worrying that people would think they had lost their job because they'd done something because of their race, or that race would come into the explanation for why they were unemployed, even when that was not the case. Other black participants talked about being worried that if they took a lower-level job, so for example, Janelle was a college-educated online programming manager for a TV station, and she lost her job. She was laid off. It was nothing she did wrong. They were cutting costs. She was offered a job as a product demonstrator at Walmart. You know, the people who hand you some meat or some product to try, some crackers or some jelly or whatever it might be. And they said, well, the products will vary, but, you know, it's a job. So she was offered this job, and she was really concerned that if she took this job that she would sort of confirm the stereotype. But she was about to also lose her apartment. So she was really in this bind. Overall, they were more resilient, and these participants credited that to their parents. They credited that to thinking about how disadvantaged they could be in comparison to where they were.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dawn, thank you so much for joining us. That was Dawn R. Norris, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW-La Crosse. She talked with us about how losing a job affects more than just your finances. Her book is called Job Loss, Identity, and Mental Health.
And you can share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. If you had a hard time with job loss, what did you learn from that experience? You can let us know and see what other people are saying, too, over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Today is a day just about everybody can get behind. It's National Pancake Day. The day, according to our good friend Wikipedia, grew out of Shrove Tuesday, a time to use up rich foods before Lent. In some countries, that means eating pancakes.
The chain IHOP got involved and began celebrating the day as National Pancake Day in 2006. As for pancakes in general, I can find almost nothing bad to say about pancakes. They just make life better.
It's true. And I have a really tasty flour-free recipe that I know it sounds suspect, but I just found it recently and I've tried it and I'm obsessed with it. So it's just 2 ounces of cream cheese and then 2 eggs and then like a teaspoon to 2 teaspoons of sugar or sugar substitute. You whip those up in a blender. It doesn't take long. Let the bubbles settle just a little bit and then cook it in, I do a little mix between butter and canola oil so you get that really buttery flavor, but also you can make it hot. And I don't even put syrup on it. I sprinkle it with a little cinnamon and a little cocoa powder, and it is so good.
That sounds good. That's, you know, the pancakes are so versatile. My husband has a specialty, and it's oat nut pancakes that even the kids like, although they have nuts and oats. They have nuts and oats in them. They're surprisingly good. You almost can't go wrong with pancakes.
It's true. Anything like that, crepe, I mean, they're so versatile.
And you'll be bringing in pancakes tomorrow, right, Judy?
Sure, yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'll wait for next Pancake Day.
Happy Pancake Day. This is Central Time.